This is Pilar Harkless. The date is September 25th, 2020. The city is Corpus Christi, State, Texas. I'm interviewing Thomas Odom. Topic of interview is Terrence McNally and the theater. Do you have your consent to record?
Yes, you do.
All right. So how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm glad it's Friday. It's going to be a nice weekend, I think.
Oh, yeah. I'm really excited to interview you.
Great. And I'm excited to be here.
I'm glad. Before I get started, I want to tell the listening audience a little bit more about you.
Mm-hmm.
So I want you to know that this is Dr. Thomas A. Odom. He is an assistant professor of theater studies at Texas A&M University, Corpus Christi. He teaches classes in theater history, script analysis, playwriting, and dramaturgy. He holds a Bachelor's of Arts in English and History from the University of Nebraska, a Master's of Fine Arts in Dramaturgy from Columbia University, and a PhD in theater history from Indiana University. His research interests include onstage representations of violence from early modern England and 1990s Britain. Tom previously taught at Colby College and holds dramaturgy credits from educational and professional theaters in Indiana, New York, Maine, and Nebraska. His writings on topics from revenge tragedy to in-your-face theater has appeared in Theater Journal, The Routledge Companion to Dramaturgy, Ecumenia, and the New England Theater Journal, amongst others. That's quite an impressive resume.
Thank you.
So how have you been staying busy during this COVID-19?
Oh, goodness. There is plenty to keep yourself busy with these days, what with teaching classes and trying to keep everybody together and try to keep everybody engaged and try to keep everybody in good spirits, right? I'm currently teaching three classes, and just with all the masks and physical distance, it takes a bit of energy, you know? So I think it's going well so far, but it does take quite a lot of planning and quite a lot of preparation.
Yes. Have you been doing any binge watching?
Oh, quite a bit. You know, being in the theater, I was fortunate and happy to see that a lot of theaters have recently put a lot of their work, a lot of their plays, a lot of their musicals on streaming video services online or through sites like Netflix or Disney Plus or Broadway HD. That has been a boon to both theater lovers and theater researchers. But you know, I also just like to kick back and watch some good old TV now and then. In terms of the binging, I definitely made it through really fast this great new comedy. It's been around a couple of seasons now. It's on Hulu and it's called Rami. It's just really eye-opening sitcom, but a sitcom with depth, because it's about this young man of Islamic faith, a young Muslim man living in New Jersey, trying to navigate being a single guy, trying to navigate being a young man, trying to navigate his family and his faith. And it just asks a lot of really interesting questions about who we are as a country, who we are as a people, who we are living in today's world. But it does so in quite funny ways sometimes.
Oh, okay. This sounds interesting. I'm going to have to look at it.
Yeah.
So can you tell me more about your role as an assistant professor at Texas A&M University, Corpus Christi?
Absolutely. Yeah. I've been here now for a little over a year. I started work here last fall. And, I teach classes in what we like to call theater studies. So I'm not usually the one teaching an acting class or a costume design class or a stage direction sort of class. I teach the classes that involve a lot of literature and history, you know, theater history, script analysis, those sorts of things. So anytime that there's a lot of books involved, anytime there's a lot of reading involved, it's probably for one of my classes. Right now we're reading a lot, and we're studying. Right now I just got finished teaching a class in classical Japanese theater in my theater history class. So I like to try to branch out and open students' minds to different things, you know, different places, different eras, different histories. And that's my role here in the department. But there's, you know, lots of other people. We're a nice, cozy family, I think. And everybody's been great. Like I said, been here a year. I feel at home already. And everybody's super friendly, from the professors to the students to the staff. And everybody you meet around this place just seems like a great place to work and a great place to live.
Wow. Sounds wonderful. So what would be the main lessons you would want your students to take away from your classes?
I think I want them to be able to approach their art, their work, everything about who they are as a theater maker. I want them to approach that with an open mind, right? A lot of the plays I teach aren't going to be things that they're super familiar with already. I mean, I teach plays that are, you know, 2,500 years old. I teach plays that were written in all these different languages, different cultures, different theater-going people, different art forms in general, different aesthetic styles. And to be able to read, to see, to think about all of these different plays and writers and styles, and not immediately jump to a conclusion like, oh, I don't like it because it's unfamiliar to me. I want them to back up a step and say, what was this situation like? What was the culture like? Where did this come from? And how can I better understand that? How can I inform myself by doing a little bit of research, doing a little bit of reading? And hopefully, how can I learn from this and make myself a better artist in the future?
Okay. Well, what about you? Can you tell us a little bit about your background? Where did you grow up, and where did you get an interest in theater?
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. That is its own story, I guess. You know, I grew up in small town, big town. It depends on your definition of these things. Small town, Nebraska. it's not going to impress anybody from a big city, but for Nebraska, it was kind of a big place. You know, a whole like 25,000 people, right?
What city was it?
The name is Hastings, Hastings, Nebraska. Born and raised from a pretty big family, youngest of five. And so I just grew up, and most of my siblings were active in arts, performance arts or musical arts somehow, right? Whether they played an instrument, but several of them did act in the high school plays. And so I grew up watching all of my family do the high school plays. And of course, then when I got to high school, I said, well, I want to do the same thing. That seems like a good time. It seems like a great educational opportunity. And so I did. I, you know, did the high school musicals, the high school plays, and you know, it's what they say, the bug just bit me, and I kept on at it. I kept on going to school for it, going to both undergraduate and two different graduate schools, and just decided to keep making that my life from then on there. So.
Okay. So, what was your favorite role that you played?
Oh, well, I must start off by saying it has been quite some time since I acted last. I've largely stepped off the stage and into the classroom for the most part. But back years ago, when I was still doing the acting thing, it was probably in a musical called Into the Woods. It's a relatively well-known musical. They made a movie of it a couple of years ago, right? It's about all these fairy tale stories, and they're set to song, and there's a lot of great twists on all these classic fairy tales. And I played Jack, as in Jack and the Beanstalk. And it's just one of those experiences. I think I was a sophomore in high school, so really young, really just energetic and engaged, and fell in love with not just the songs and the stories and the being on stage, but also just being part of a community, being around the people who were doing the same thing that I was and loving the same things that I were. And I think that really was one of my first major experiences. And looking back on it, yeah, it's still up there as probably my favorite experience.
Okay, that was a Sondheim musical?
Yeah, Stephen Sondheim. He's
so you were singing?
Great composer.
Singing?
Yes. I did a little singing back in the day. I'm not gonna say that I was necessarily the next next star, but okay. I did a little.
Okay. So let's talk about your research interest. That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Representations of violence from early modern England and 1990s Britain and in-your-face theater. What is that about?
Oh, goodness. Yes. Well, to talk about in-your-face theater, I think we should just think about the way we label things. Anytime we want to call something, put a name on something, we're making a decision, whether that's something like, this is a comedy, right? This is a tragedy. This is a melodrama. And, you know, that takes a decision on our part as thinkers, as scholars, as artists, as people who just like to watch stuff. We think about these things and we label them. And so, in the 1990s, a bunch of young, active, dynamic playwrights were making a lot of big, bold choices. And this is primarily in London that I'm talking about, but various places all over Britain and Ireland. A bunch of young playwrights were making waves, as they say, drawing attention to themselves, drawing attention to their writing, drawing attention to their theaters, and oftentimes being quite controversial about it. Making headlines, causing disturbances and causing boycotts and that sort of thing. And so after a few years of this, there becomes a sense that this is part of something bigger, right? This is a trend. These are people doing the same thing. So let's put them in the same bucket, put them in the same category. And there's a very famous label that one particular critic, scholar, called them, and he said, these people are making in-your-face theater because they're bold, they're brash, they're shaking audiences up, they're causing controversy, they're giving us new experiences with their new dynamic playwriting. And, you know, like any label that can be useful, and it certainly draws attention to some of the things they're doing, but like any label, it can also be not what everybody expects, not what everybody wants. Some people hate the term in-your-face theater. Some people love the term in-your-face theater. And so I discovered a lot of these young writers, now not so young because the 1990s were several decades ago, but as I was studying, I discovered these writers, and I decided that I wanted to look at them a little bit more in depth and see what was all the fuss about, right? And that's in-your-face theater and how I came onto it through my own studies.
Okay. Can you give us, like, some examples of what they did that was, like, in-your-face?
Oh, sure. And to set the stage, we should probably take ourselves back to the 1990s. Because none of these people were out to just shock or scare for the heck of it. You know, they were trying to make a point. And you look back then and you see all the unrest in the world. And in particular, people were talking about violence in the wars of Eastern Europe, like in the former Yugoslavia, or the wars in Central Africa, like in Rwanda. And all of these horrible things, all of these atrocities that people were doing to each other in these wars. And one particular playwright named Sarah Kane wrote a very famous, perhaps I should say very infamous play called mm-hmm. Blasted. And in this play, it's set in England, in a pretty nice, what the English people would say, posh hotel room. And mm-hmm. these two main characters, and then a third character enters partway through, they just spend the whole play, and probably between 90 minutes and 2 hours when you're watching it, they spend this whole time just doing terrible things to each other. They start by calling each other vicious names, and they sexually assault each other. They Oh. commit violence, just horrible violence. There's acts of brutality that for purposes of taste, I'm not going to go into details, but let me just say that multiple characters end up dead by the end of the play, and mm-hmm. horrible violence is done to their bodies. And people saw this play, and they were quite upset, naturally. But I think the question then is, what do we do with this upset? You know, do we sit around and say, how dare you put these vile things on stage, which is what some people did, or we take a step back and listen to her, listen to the playwright, when she says, I'm trying to bring that experience of those atrocities of Bosnia, the atrocities of the former Yugoslav war, I'm trying to bring those atrocities into the comfortable lives of English people and to try to make them feel something like that. Mm-hmm. And so those are the sorts of experiences that the in-your-face theater can bring to even the most, you know, well-off, comfortable, posh, rich London spectators.
Okay. So would you say, well, let's talk about Terrence McNally. He would kind of be in your face too, huh?
Oh, I can see the connection there. Certainly, with some of his work, he meant for audiences to, you know, take that step back and ask ourselves, what are we doing here? Can I look at the world in a slightly different way, right? Because he, you know, different stories between sort of the violence of in-your-face theater and Terrence McNally's identity, but asking us to really look at theater as an art form that has the potential to change people and to change people's minds, to change people's hearts, and to change the world a little bit.
Okay. Can you give us a little background on him? I know that he was a prolific playwright. He wrote starting in the 1960s and wrote up basically up to his death, which is recent in March, from complications of COVID-19.
Yes, yes. Sad death due to the coronavirus, Terrence McNally. Yeah, but he is quite prolific, and quite prolific in a number of different styles and genres and just different ways of storytelling, different ways of playwriting. He wrote, you know, farces. He wrote musicals. He wrote very serious, realistic dramas. He wrote, mostly he's famous for, cataloging and describing and, holding up for society's benefit his identity as a gay man. And I think he spoke to a lot to this LGBTQ experience in America throughout the late 20th century, especially, and asking mainstream audiences. Remember, these are big theaters. These are, you know, Broadway houses, big commercial award-winning plays that he's writing, and he's mm-hmm. trying to give that experience a voice. And he's one of the most famous, most successful in terms of, you know, financial success and, you know, winning awards. He's one of the most successful people to have done it in that time.
Yes. Okay, I know that he won a lot of awards, but his most controversial play was Corpus Christi, in which he made Jesus and the disciples all gay men. And that was like during the height of the AIDS crisis. What do you think he was doing that for?
Oh, I think absolutely to bring attention to people, to his people, really, this LGBTQ, and he specifically as a white gay man, were this time period of the 80s and into the early 90s was just a devastating series of deaths. Entire generations of young gay men were wiped out from the AIDS crisis, the AIDS epidemic. And people for far too long ignored the problem. People didn't take action. They saw that community as other than me, other than normal people in, you know, quote unquote, normal people. I don't need to worry about them over there, right? Because I am safe over here. Yeah. And he asked us with Corpus Christi in a very provocative way to look at, you know, how we relate to one another as simple human beings. And especially if you are a person of the Christian faith, I think he's asking you, what does it mean to love one another? What does it mean to love each other, love my brother, love my neighbor as thyself, right? And if we step back and ask, who is my brother? Who is my neighbor? All of these things that you know, that people of the Christian faith should by rights be asking themselves. I think he's asking us to take a step back and say, well, isn't a gay man also your brother? Isn't a gay man also your neighbor? Isn't a gay man as worthy of Christian charity as anybody else? Yeah. And I think this question of love, this question of support, this question of giving attention where it is due in the midst of some of the most intense stresses, pressures, and devastating loss that the community ever faced.
I find it interesting. He's actually the native son here, Corpus Christi, that he would use that name as the name of his play.
Oh, yeah. And honestly, I didn't even realize that McNally was from Corpus Christi until after I'd been here a few months, and I was just talking to one of my colleagues about this, and he said, oh yeah, Terrence McNally's from here. And I said, oh, I didn't realize that. And then of course, oh yeah, the irony of Corpus Christi. But the intriguing thing, then this goes back to my theater history classes, is that the phrase Corpus Christi has a long standing presence in the history of the theater, because Corpus Christi, if you know your Latin, means the body of Christ. And it is a festival in the Catholic Church. And part of that festival over the course of time, especially in the Middle Ages, but part of the festival has always involved theater to a certain extent, always involved sort of like medieval pageants and medieval morality plays. And so the phrase Corpus Christi, if you say that to any theater historian, their eyes are probably going to light up in a way.
How do you think that he affected the theater?
Oh, I think he has a long and profound effect. Again, as I mentioned before, a lot of very commercially successful and artistically successful plays. He wrote big statement musicals like Kiss of the Spider Woman or Ragtime, both of which he won Tony Awards for. And so that fact alone, you know, puts him in the history books, right? And both of those musicals ask you to look at people and their social positions and their relationships. And of course, he absolutely chronicles the life of the gay man, the American gay man. And one of his Tony Award winning plays, Love, Valor, Compassion, is a quite well known, quite often revived and quite studied play. And it's just this, I talked about how he works in several different styles and several different genres, from farce to the metaphor of Corpus Christi. But this is just straightforward realism, straightforward tugging at the heartstrings, watching people live their lives while they live, while they love, while they laugh, and, you know, in some cases suffer. And I think any look at the theater community in the United States, especially in the 1980s and 1990s, is going to have to deal with the question of the LGBTQ community because of the AIDS crisis, number one, but because a lot of people who work in the theater are tied to that community, whether they're gay themselves or lesbians themselves, transgender themselves, or whether they're allies and family members and loved ones. So I think speaking these truths, talking about these experiences, bringing that to very large, very commercially minded theaters, I think he will have a lasting impact for the issues of representation, at very least.
Okay. Well, from your experience, how has the theater changed over the years?
Oh, that's a great question. And I can speak to a couple of different things that I've seen. And I'll start with where I ended that last answer with, issues of representation, because I think that's probably the one that's most pressing and most present in the culture today, because we like to tell stories. We like to tell stories about ourselves, and we like to think that we're always telling the right story. But for far too long, especially in this country, but, you know, throughout world history, only certain people have been recognized as the storytellers. Yeah. You know, oftentimes that's men, obviously. But there are other issues of identity, issues of representation that come into play here. Oftentimes it's white men. Oftentimes it's, you know, rich white men, for example.
Yes, okay.
And so the question we've been asking ourselves with more and more frequency over the past few decades, and heck, even within the last year itself, with all of the things that have been coming to the foreground of society, coming to the foreground of news stories, we've been asking, who are the people who are telling the stories? Who are the people we're letting into the room? Who are the people we're giving the stage to, quite literally? Who are the people we're giving money to put on these stories? And we're asking, well, are there better opportunities if we let more, you know, more diverse stories be told? Should we give priority to people who have not been telling their stories? And so I think we're starting to see, there's still certainly obviously a lot of room to grow, but a rise in prominence of certain African American voices, a rise in prominence of certain Latino, Latina, and Hispanic voices, a certain rise in prominence of female voices, right? 51% of the population can't be a minority, right?
Okay.
So I think that in terms of the content of the storytelling, I think this is certainly the most important change that's going on, been going on for a while, but certainly will be going on well into the future as we start to challenge ourselves to be more equitable and be more diverse in exactly who gets to tell their stories. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and content isn't the only way that theater has changed, by no means, because form or the way that the story is being told, the way it looks, the way it feels, that also mm-hmm. has changed throughout history as well, you know, from, okay. you know, ancient Greek tragedy with big choruses, right, to you know, Shakespeare with rhyming couplets and that sort of thing. But today we have a lot of new technologies that I think we're playing with, whether that be, you know, putting screens on stage, you know, that to show that that aspect of technology, whether that be using multimedia, like using the internet, using web streams. Heck, we could even turn this into a play, what we're doing right now. We could live stream this play. And in fact, that is what we're experimenting with right here at TAM-UCC in our theater department. Our next couple of plays are going to be streamed through the technology of web video and the internet. But it doesn't have to be all this fancy multimedia stuff. Technology has also absolutely changed the way we do sets and lighting on stage, right? You mm-hmm. probably are familiar with big turntables and all these motorized apparatuses. These things have been growing and becoming more and more a part of theater for decades now. So I think big fundamental technological changes can influence every aspect of the form of theatrical storytelling.
Okay, so it's kind of speaking to this generation that's more technologically involved.
I hope so, yeah. Yeah, and there are I think there's good things, and I think there's bad things about that. The good things is broadening our horizon of what theater storytelling can be, can make us think in different ways. If we see a screen on stage, does that make us step back and reflect a little bit more? Oh, what is on that screen? How am I relating to the screen differently than I'm relating to, say, a person on stage? Is that, you know, making a comment? Are there interactions that I should be aware of between screens and people? I think we can ask very interesting questions doing that on stage. And I think that the fact that so many of our young people have screens as part of their daily existence invites them to play a part in that theatrical storytelling more fundamentally than they might otherwise be engaged with. But I do think that there are certain drawbacks as well. All of this technology comes with a price, obviously. And if we are raising ticket prices, for example, to pay for all of this new technology, is that limiting the people we'll be able to serve with our stories? I hope that we can find a good balance there, because at the end of the day, there is a fundamental, unique benefit, a unique style, a unique experience that theater is to okay. be in the same room with somebody else. Goodness knows, okay. right now especially, that is a wild part of our wildest dreams, to be in the same room as somebody else and to experience, to look the artist directly in the eyes, to breathe the same air as them. That's a profoundly moving experience, and I hope that that part of theater never fully goes away.
Okay, so we should say to the Netflix generation that we should at least try the theater.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All right. Well, let me ask you, if you were to write the very next play, based on all the things that are going on in the world and addressing them, what would you write about?
Oh, goodness.
Well, what would you call it?
What would I write about and what would I call it? I think I should start off by saying that I primarily write about the theater. I write essays and critical works, right? I am not well renowned as a playwright myself, but if I were to sort of sit down and look at the world today and look at the storytelling that our stages and our theaters need, I think I would have to write about inequality in some way, whether that be inequality of money or inequality of opportunity. And just sort of thinking about my life and my place in the world, and how fortunate I've been, and yet how much inequality there is still in the world. I would like to explore that in some way, shape, or form, to again draw our attention to, kind of like what the in-your-face theater playwrights or Terrence McNally did, to draw our attention to some of the things we need to look at in society. And in terms of what I call it, well, I've never been particularly clever with titles, so I think I'm just going to steal a pre-existing title. There's a kind of famous play out there called The Man from Nebraska, which okay. I identify with clearly. And so my working title, if you'll allow me that, would be The Man from Nebraska.
Okay, who would you get to star in that?
Oh, geez. Well, if somebody's going to play me, I'm kind of hard to cast because I'm kind of short, so and many actors who are short don't make good leading men, so they always want the tall dashing people. So one of my favorite shall we say not quite as tall as Superman actors. I could see Elijah Wood playing me. He's a good actor.
Okay, Elijah Wood. What do you think about the movement right now to get people of different colors or a woman to play a man, usually a man's role in a play, about changing up who plays these characters?
I think it has amazing potential and amazing opportunities to present the world as it is. I think we need to be careful about who gets to speak for whom, no matter what we're doing. As long as we're thoughtful and take into consideration exactly what we're saying and why we're making these choices, I think, again, the more voices involved, the better, every single time. The more voices, the better.
Okay. Well, have you met anyone famous?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I mean, when you live in New York City, and especially if you work in theater in New York City, you're gonna run across celebrities. And I think part of the challenge of working in theater or working in entertainment in general, or living in big cities, is to not lose your cool, right? To not freak out whenever you see them. And you can tell the new people in town because they start to go, they get all gaga-eyed and googly-eyed whenever they see celebrities, and the people who've lived in New York for years just walk on by, right? So, yeah, it happens all the time. It really does. But probably my favorite story involves actually another Stephen Sondheim musical.
Okay.
We talked about him earlier in this interview. I was I was walking down the street past a theater. I wasn't even going to see the theater. I wasn't going to see the show, but the theater was playing the musical Sweeney Todd, another pretty famous movie. Pretty famous musical. Walking past the theater, I was actually meeting up a friend who was, I could see just down the street about a block away. And so I was walking past the theater, not even thinking about it, walking towards my friend. But as I glanced over, the doors to the theater were all glass, and you could look into the lobby. You could see into the theater lobby, and standing in the middle of the theater lobby was Johnny Depp. I come to find out later, of course, he's preparing to play Sweeney Todd in the movie version. I didn't know that at the time. I just thought to myself, isn't that Johnny Depp? And kept on walking, because that's what you do. You don't make a big deal out of a celebrity signing, right? But then I told my friend, and he kind of freaked out. And he said, let's go look. And by the time he got to the door, Johnny Depp had already ducked back into the theater, and we couldn't see him anymore. So, but the funny thing was that we actually hung around the stage door for a little while longer, because my friend actually, he wanted to get an autograph of the actress who was in the musical, another pretty famous actress, at least for theater people. Her name's Patti LuPone. So he's like, oh, I want to get Patti LuPone's autograph. And I was like, okay, we'll wait around for Patti LuPone. And then lo and behold, out walks Johnny Depp. So,
all right.
my friend did.
Persistence.
After missing him the first time around, got to see him a few minutes later. So that's a pretty entertaining. Although, as I said, not that atypical for living in New York. You see those sorts of things all the time.
Oh yes. Well, I would have been with your friend. I love Johnny Depp. Okay, well, I know you mentioned that you are doing something there currently at the theater at Texas A&M Corpus Christi. Can you give us a little hint about it?
Oh, absolutely. And it is kind of thrilling to talk about this right now, and especially to talk about this over a web video chat like we are right now, because we are staging a play in a streaming format. We're doing it all live via this video chat, and the play is called The Book of Will by Lauren Gunderson, and it's running October 6th through 11th. So you can, first of all, before I go any further, go to our website, get your tickets now. It will be streaming. And which is a unique challenge for theater people who are used to acting on stage. But I think it's a great fit for this play. This play, The Book of Will by Lauren Gunderson, is about William Shakespeare and how his plays lived on after his death, how his plays were printed and how his plays were published, and how his friends got together and tried to use a new and potentially confusing technology to continue to tell the stories, right? So you can almost see a kind of parallel in our theater embrace of the web stream, the theater embrace of the internet, as parallel to how these actors embraced mass market printing for the first time in order to keep on telling their stories through a new technology. And it's a lighthearted comedy, but it's got some funny bits, but it's also got some touching bits and some a little bit sad bits too. But it's just quite a charming play. It's set in 1600s England, but don't let that worry about you. It's very fresh, very new, very alive, and very entertaining. And the cast and crew have just been working so hard to not only stage a play, but to figure out all the web streaming capabilities as well. And I think we're going to put on quite a delightful show. Again, October 6th through 11th. Check our website right now.
Okay, great. Great plug for it, too. This is theater during the pandemic, I guess. So yeah,
that's a lot of places are doing similar things right now. You've got to Got to roll with the changes, I guess.
Yes. Well, I want to tell you, I have very much enjoyed interviewing you today, and I thank you for sharing your life with us for this time, and it's really been interesting, and I hope everybody's going to just download this and love it. So,
well, thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity.
All right. Well, once again, we are sitting here talking to Mr. Odom, Dr. Odom, and we are very thankful. So we hope that you'll have a wonderful day and continue your work.
Thank you. You too.
All right. Goodbye.
Goodbye.